This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Coming up, as we head into graduation season, we want to talk about a new report about changes and challenges at the nation's historically black colleges and universities. That's coming up. But first, it's also the beginning of what has been historically the spring home buying season. So over the next few weeks, we're going to talk from time to time about important issues related to housing. And there's some good news there. Sales are going up while foreclosures are going down. But our next guest says a lot of those numbers don't quite add up to a real recovery, especially for potential homeowners. In fact, the percentage of Americans who own homes is still in decline. We wanted to talk more about that, so we've called upon Rana Farooqar. She is an assistant managing editor for Time magazine. She covers business and economics. She recently wrote a piece that caught our attention. It's called The Housing Mirage, and she's with us now. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So why mirage? You quote an expert who says we're not seeing a housing recovery. It's a housing pre-covery. What does that mean?
That's right. Well, what's happening is that, yes, home prices are going up, foreclosures are going down, as you mentioned, but who's doing the buying? At this point, the market is being driven by investors. And when I say investors, I mean not only private equity firms that are buying up 20,000 properties and renting them out, but also very rich individuals who can afford to, say, pay cash down for an apartment or a home. They might then be renting that out to garner additional income themselves. What's missing is that folks that still depend on mortgages are out of the market. I mean, they are really not in the market en masse yet. We're seeing those numbers tick up just a little bit, but the market is being driven by investors, and that's because credit is still very tight. Banks are just not giving out loans, and credit standards are still much tighter than they were before the financial crisis.
You also talk about the fact that there's a geographic split, that there are some cities that are doing pretty well, and other areas are not doing well at all. Why would that be? Are investors just more attracted to some areas than others?
Well, you know, like everything in our economy, we've got sort of a two-tier recovery. We've got parts of the country that are doing very well. We've got types of people that are doing well. We've got jobs that are doing well. But it's a very two Americas kind of scenario. So there are places like D.C., L.A., parts of New York that are booming, really, you know, and in part driven, again, by those investors, often foreign buyers, people that are still at the top tier of the job market who are actually doing pretty well. But you've got other cities, Detroit, parts of the Inland Empire, as they say in California, that are still awash in foreclosures and really having a hard time. So the housing recovery, or pre-covery, as I call it, is very geographically mixed, depending on where you go.
How important is a healthy housing recovery? I'm trying to figure out if I can get you to explain why this matters to somebody who doesn't need a house, isn't looking for a house. I mean, you can understand why if you let's say you're a newlywed, you're ready for that first home, you keep trying to buy a home and you keep getting beaten out by investors who can pay cash and you can't. You can see why that's annoying. But let's say that's not you. Why does this matter to the rest of the country?
It's a great question. And the answer is that we live in a consumer economy. Our economy is made up of about 70% consumer spending. There's nothing that stimulates consumer spending like housing wealth. Every dollar of increased housing wealth has a much greater knock-on effect in the rest of the economy. Because if you think about it, when you buy a house, you also have to buy stuff to go in it, right? And housing wealth, we can really feel that. That makes us feel secure, much more so even than stock wealth, which is a kind of a more just sort of ephemeral thing. You don't really feel it like you do a house. So when housing wealth goes up, when the housing market is healthy, you really start to get that healthy consumer economy that we need to have a really robust recovery.
We're speaking with Time magazine's Rana Farooqar, who recently wrote a piece titled The Housing Mirage. Can we talk more about why this problem persists? There have been a number of programs, interventions that the Obama administration has announced with much fanfare. None of those things seem to make a difference. I mean, you point out that the home ownership rate is lower than it's been in decades.
That's right.
We had a guest last week who also is an expert on housing finance, and he says that the lending guidelines are still too tight, that they're too unforgiving. Other people would say that's ridiculous, that part of the reason we're in the situation that we're in is that there are too many people given loans that they simply couldn't afford and couldn't pay for. What's your take on this?
The truth is, not to be a three-handed economist here, but the truth is that both of those things have a little bit of merit. I mean, let's face it, before the crisis, there were a lot of problematic loans. Home ownership is not for everybody, and we don't want to go back to that period. But right now, credit is not too far from where it was right after Lehman Brothers fell, despite the fact that the economy, it really has gone into a recovery, and we're in a very different place now. Now, that comes down to the banks. Why are the banks being so tight about giving out credit? Well, in part, because they don't know what their business model is going to be in the future. They don't know what the rules of the road are going to be. So one thing to keep in mind is that Dodd-Frank, the piece of legislation that was signed into law 3 years ago that is going to be re-regulating the banking sector and trying to make it safer, really cleaning up the banking sector, it's still being written. 3 years on from being signed into law, those rules are still being written. So banks and financial institutions are waiting to see what their landscape is going to look like before they start making those loans over 15 or 30-year periods.
Well, there are those who argue really what they're doing is just profit taking.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, you know, I think that there's probably some truth in that, too. And I think, you know, we need to tell the banks, regulators need to tell the banks, Congress needs to come up with rules for Dodd-Frank and tell the banks, are you going to be allowed to mix certain kinds of more profitable trading with the plain vanilla lending and the mortgage lending that we so desperately need? I would also go back, frankly, to the beginnings of the financial crisis and say that we probably should have prioritized saving homeowners as much, if not more, than saving banks. And I think that that's something a lot of people would say in retrospect.
What's the chicken and what's the egg? I mean, there are a lot of people saying part of the problem here that housing is dragging because employment is dragging. There are still a lot of people who aren't making enough money or aren't working enough hours to give them the resources to either buy a home, compete effectively for a home, or clean up their credit. What's your take on this?
I would say the conventional wisdom over the last decade or so has been that you need a healthy housing market to have a real recovery. But actually, I think you probably have to flip it. Ultimately, the thing that drives housing is employment. If employment starts to come down, if wages start to go up, if people have money in their pockets, and if their credit is better, then they're going to be able to get loans and the housing market is going to rise. So I think really we need to flip it and say a healthy housing market depends on a robust economic recovery.
You're saying that the kind of conventional wisdom has been that, you know, housing really leads the recovery in this country. In the past, what levers have been pushed to get that going? And are those levers just not available right now?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, and that comes down to monetary policy, which is about interest rates. The Fed, Federal Reserve, controls how interest rates rise and fall. And we've been in a period of declining interest rates for a long time now. I mean, you know, interest rates are 2.56%, something like that. I mean, these are record lows, historic lows. So there's not a lot more that the Fed can do to bring that interest rate down and stimulate someone who wants to buy a new house to say, hey, borrowing costs are really low. I'm going to go out and take that leap. And if you look back 20 years ago, 30 years ago in the 70s, we were in double-digit interest rates. You know, my parents, when they bought a home, were probably paying 11-12% on a loan. And now you can pay under 3%. It's kind of incredible. So we've sort of maxed out our policy levers. What we really need to do is focus on jobs and unemployment to get people able to have the money to spend on a house.
But why is it, though, with money that cheap, that more individual homeowners can't take advantage of that? You know, why is that?
This goes back to that credit issue, because if you need a mortgage, it doesn't matter if the interest rate is 3%, 2%, 11%. If you don't have that down payment, if you don't, if the bank can't look at you and say, hey, you're a good credit risk, we think that that job you got is going to last and your wages are strong enough, then they're not going to give you that loan. So that's why investors who have cash in hand are driving this market. Nobody will argue with an all-cash sale.
That's true. So what about – so two more questions if we can. Is there anything wrong with the fact that investors are buying up these homes? Is there something bad about that?
No, there's not something bad about it. And in fact, you might find some people that would say, you know, we should have more renters in this country. So to the extent that investors tend to be people who buy up properties and then offer them up as rental homes and rental apartments, maybe that's a good thing. Bob Shiller, the famous professor at Yale who predicted the housing crisis and now runs the Case-Shiller Housing Economic Indicators, would probably argue that renting is a great idea. That said, there are still a lot of people people that want to own a home. It is a very entrenched part of the American dream. And in some cities, it makes a lot of sense. You know, I happen to live in Brooklyn, New York. Supply is 44% down from its norms, which means that rental properties and rental prices are really rising. So if you have some money and you can get a mortgage with a low interest rate, it's actually a great time to get in and buy rather than pay a high rental.
And finally, is there anything that the home buyer who we're talking about here, somebody who wants to buy a home, hasn't been able to do so yet, can do to make mm-hmm. himself or herself more attractive to lenders? Or is this really, in your opinion, a policy issue? This is an issue for regulators. They need to jawbone or do whatever it is they have to do to get lenders to loosen the reins. Mm.
It's largely a policy issue. It's largely, as I say, a macroeconomic issue in the sense that it's about unemployment. When we have lower unemployment and when wages can finally start rising and people can bring down their debt levels if they need to and get those credit ratings where they ought to be, then we'll have a stronger market for people who need mortgages. I'll give you a number that's fairly telling. Most lenders would like to see a credit rating of around 750. Most Americans have credit below 700. That tells you sort of where we're at.
Rana Faruhar is an assistant managing editor at Time Magazine. We were talking about her recent piece, The Housing Mirage. She was with us from Time's offices in New York City. Rana, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we want to tell you about a new bill making its way through Congress that would allow employers to offer time off instead of overtime pay when employees work extra hours. Supporters say it's just giving people what they want, more flexibility and a more family-friendly workplace. So why do some critics say it could actually hurt employees? We'll talk about that in just a few minutes. But first, we're going to talk about news from historically black colleges and universities, also called HBCUs. According to a new report called The Changing Face of Historically Black Colleges and Universities, many of the nation's top HBCUs showed a substantial increase in graduation rates in recent years. We wanted to know more about this and other interesting information from the report, so we've called its author, Mary Beth Gassman. She's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Graduate School of Education, where she studies historically black schools. Welcome back, Professor Gassman. Thanks for joining us once again.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Also joining us for additional perspective is David Wilson, the president of Morgan State University. That's an historically black college in Baltimore. President Wilson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Professor Gassman, let's start with you, because on this program, we've spoken with you, we've spoken with others about what's been perceived as a crisis time for HBCUs in recent years. But your study outlines some areas of growth that may surprise some people, and I want to start with this increase in the graduation rate. Why is that?
Well, I think that HBCUs for several years now have been focusing heavily on retention. The focus of foundations across the country on degree attainment has also had a positive impact on HBCUs in that their focus now is not only access, but it's also success. And that has played out in HBCUs doing better when it comes to their graduation rates, especially considering that they educate low-income students of color who oftentimes are underprepared.
You do mention in the report that a lot of the top HBCUs showed increasing graduation rates, but you still find that on average, as a group, the schools are graduating 30% of students in 6 years, and that does not compare favorably to majority institutions. And tell me why that is.
If you look at the percentage of Pell Grant recipients, and if you look at the average SAT score, and you look at the expenditures by the state for the institutions, as well as the percentage of students of color, you will see that the graduation rates are substantially different. And the issue is that HBCUs tend to enroll lower income students, and income correlates with graduation. And so whereas a lot of majority institutions, they don't enroll a lot of Pell Grant eligible students, and they also don't enroll students who might have lower SAT scores, HBCUs do. So they are really doing the lion's share of the work when it comes to low-income students in general, and especially low-income students of color.
President Wilson, we note that Morgan State University's graduation rate is just under 40%. Now, you've been at Morgan State since July of 2010, but you've had a long career in higher education before that, working at both, you know, majority and minority institutions. So could you talk a little bit about this from your perspective? What have you seen?
Certainly, since I have been at Morgan, we have seen an uptick in our graduation rate here. We've seen a significant uptick in our retention rate. We basically have instituted here at Morgan and some of the other HBCUs across the country as well, something that we call intrusive intervention. It means that, you know, we really begin to track our students' progress from the moment they set foot on the campus, and if they have a quiz or if they have a test in one of their courses and they don't do well, we have counselors who actually will flag them, if you will, and basically make sure that they are taking advantage of all the services that we offer as a university.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about a new report on America's historically black colleges and universities, the HBCUs. Our guests are the report's author, Professor Mary Beth Gassman of the University of Pennsylvania. Also with us, David Wilson, president of Morgan State University. Professor Gassman, one of the other interesting findings in your report, you talked about people of color. You really meant it, that the percentage of students who are not African American are attending these schools at much higher rates. For example, since 1980, Hispanic and Latino enrollment at HBCUs has jumped 123%. Asian enrollment has increased by 60%. White enrollment has remained a steady 13% for the past 20 years, which is kind of interesting. Why is it that other students of color are increasingly attracted to these institutions?
People have been aware of the white presence, but the Latino and Asian presence is a little bit of a new. And I think there are a couple of reasons. One, especially for Latinos, and my research team has done some work interviewing some Latino students, and they say that it's a very nurturing environment, it's a family-like environment, and they feel empowered, and they actually feel loved at the institutions. And so you're seeing that, especially in the state of Texas, you're seeing large increases, but across the areas where there are large populations of Latinos, but even in North Carolina. And then among Asians, students, you're seeing that a lot of their reasons have to do with the low tuition and the accessibility. They tend to be gravitating toward the public HBCUs. Overall, non-blacks tend to go to HBCUs because of location, because of curricular programs, and because of low tuition. And then the fourth reason really is that they, unlike the experiences that many racial and ethnic minorities have at majority institutions quite often, black colleges, those in the minority, non-blacks, tend to have very positive experiences, and they tend to tell their friends about these good experiences.
Interesting. Professor Wilson, tell me about that. Has that been your experience at Morgan?
Actually, about 16% of our students here at Morgan are non-black, and certain programs actually attract a high percentage of white students. And one program in particular is our landscape architecture program here, for example, where 84% of the students in that program are white. And overall, you know, 20% of the students in our School of Architecture are white. And what I would say to that is that within the state of Maryland, there are only two schools of architecture at public institutions in the state, here at Morgan and at University of Maryland at College Park. And I think when you have high-quality programs on our campuses that are non-duplicative, that white students and other students will find those programs and they will enroll in them.
And why does that matter? Why does that matter?
I think because, of course, you know, the demographics are shifting nationally and internationally, and it's important for all of our students, I think, to be in an environment where they are interacting on a daily basis with students who are different than they are. And that would be the case whether it's Morgan or Morehouse or Harvard or Stanford.
Speaking of globally competent, Professor Gassman, you note that study abroad and foreign language programs are actually growing at HBCUs. Your report says that creating global citizens should be a prime objective for HBCUs. Why do you say that?
because if it's not a prime objective, HBCU students are going to be left behind. If more HBCUs would offer critical languages and more study abroad opportunities, they would make their students much more competitive on a global level, and that would put African Americans way out in front in terms of their opportunities with companies, in terms of their opportunities with the federal government, in terms of their opportunities abroad. It's a great area where African Americans can excel, and HBCUs can play an enormous role there.
President Wilson, I understand that this is something that you've actually advanced aggressively in your time at Morgan. Tell me, and this is your final thought, why do you think this matters?
It matters because we do not live in silos anymore. We have taken the national lead with our historically black college White House initiative, for example, with Brazil. We have exchange programs with China, with Africa. And so we understand here at Morgan, as some of my other colleagues do across HBCUs, that our students must be prepared today, as Professor Gassman indicated, to be globally competitive and to understand other histories and other cultures. And we feel that our campuses are changing to reflect that.
A final thought from you, Professor Gassman. You know, we've spent a lot of time in recent years talking about the crises affecting HBCUs, the graduation rates. Some of the schools are just falling off the cliff financially, accreditation issues. A very different tone to this report. Just overall, why do you think it is that you're seeing these areas of improvement at such a challenging time?
All too often, people talk about HBCUs, but they don't have any data to base their conversation on. And so that's one of the reasons why I wanted to do this. I wanted to do a broad look at what's going on at HBCUs and have data to back it up. And when you do that, you find that HBCUs are contributing in very important ways. And it's important to have data to show that that's taking place.
Mary Beth Gassman is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Graduate School of Education, where she studies historically black schools. She was with us from the campus of the University of Pennsylvania. Also with us, David Wilson. He is the president of Morgan State University. He joined us from WEAA in Baltimore, which I might add joins the Tell Me More listening family today. President Wilson, Professor Gassman, thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
We're switching gears now. If you're like most people out there, at some point you've probably found yourself pulling extra hours or extra shifts, and you might have looked forward to getting a little extra something in your paycheck at the end of the week or month. But now some Republicans are saying that is so old economy. They say that many workers these days would actually prefer extra time off. So last week, House Republicans used their majority to pass a bill called the Working Families Flexibility Act of 2013. They say the bill would give workers the flexibility that they need and want. But critics, including most of the Democrats who voted against the bill, say it's just a ploy to pay workers less money. Here to tell us more about this is NPR senior business editor Marilyn Gweck. She wrote about this today for NPR.org. Marilyn, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Michelle. Great to be with you.
So, Marilyn, I think a lot of people would be surprised to find out that the law is as strict on this as it is, because I think a lot of people have the experience of saying, hey, I know you need me to work this weekend. Give me a couple days off at the end of the month so I can go to my sister's wedding. But you're telling us that it's actually not supposed to work that way.
That's not what the law says. The Fair Labor Standards Act, which controls how we are supposed to work, has very little to it, actually. It just says that employers have to pay you at least the minimum wage, which is $7.25 an hour now, and you have to work a 40-hour week. If you work more than 40 hours in any one week, you get time and a half pay. There's no mention in there of comp time. But the reality is that people shift around certainly a lot within that one pay period. So, for example, it's a Tuesday night, a big project comes in, you've got to get it out of the door, you might stay late. And on Wednesday morning, you knock off, you don't come in till noon or 2 in the afternoon. People do that kind of shifting all the time, and that's fine because it all adds up to 40 hours in one week. But what this bill would do is allow you to stockpile. You could save up to 160 hours and take it much later in the year. So maybe you're working during tax time and you're really busy in late March, you're really busy in early April, but you'd like to take a lot of time off with the kids in August. You could just stockpile your comp time and then take off in August and enjoy your vacation. That's the theory.
And so technically, that unless you have a union contract that specifically permits this, you're saying that actually is not permitted now under the law. And the Republicans say, well, that makes no sense. The White House has already issued a veto threat. Democrat. And as you point out in your piece for NPR.org that's already posted, Democrats voted against this along party lines. Why is there such a strong objection to this?
Well, they feel that the law, as it is written by the Republicans who passed it in the House last week, that it would not give protections to people about when you could take that comp time. Let's say that in your vision of things, you would like to work on Saturdays in January and then have a wonderful time in July or August. But your employer might have a very different idea. She or he might force you to take that comp time, maybe next October when you don't really want it, when the kids are back in school. So could you have any control over your comp time? Not under the law. It's something that you have to work out informally with your boss. There's also a concern about, what if you work all that time in January and February and you want to take your comp time later in the year and the company goes bankrupt? Do you just lose 160 hours worth of pay? So, and there's concerns about intimidation, that once you open the door to allowing this kind of flex time, the reality will end up being that your boss kind of pushes you into situations where you end up working 20 hours one week, 60 hours the next week, that your life becomes very erratic, and that makes it a lot harder for childcare.
Well, forgive me, Marilyn, call me stupid, but isn't this exactly the kind of thing that could be worked out in committee, or these are the kinds of conversations people could have talking about this? You could put stronger language in the bill that says that the time off has to be negotiated, or that it has to be taken within a certain time frame, or that employers have to stockpile the money and put it in some sort of instrument to be sure that the money is actually paid if they can't deliver on the time off. Couldn't you work that out?
Some workers would say that if we had a smooth functioning Congress, we ought to be able to work this out. Maybe there are some compromises. For example, there's nothing in the law about paid sick days, and a lot of people would really like to be able to take paid sick days off, have some guarantee of some time off for sickness each year. A lot of people would like to see a hike in the minimum wage and have it indexed to inflation so that it would go up when the cost of living goes up. So what if you put together a bill that gave people, you know, 3 paid sick days every year and gave a minimum wage increase, and you paired it with this comp time thing? Maybe you could put together a package that fits much better with the way people are actually living, and give that kind of flexibility and yet incorporate protections. But Congress, you may have noticed, doesn't move all that smoothly these days. So what we have right now is the House passed a bill that unions feel is completely favorable to businesses, and the House passes it, but the Senate Democrats say no. So right now there's this stalemate. It would be interesting to see if they could somehow get together and find a compromise yet.
Before we let you go, Marilyn, have economists weighed in on this? This is the kind of thing where we hear a lot of high-profile business people like Sheryl Sandberg, who's gotten so much attention for talking about the way the workplace doesn't really work for the way that families work today. Mm-hmm. Have economists weighed in on this?
Yes, I talked with Nariman Baravish. He's a chief economist with IHS. That's a pretty well-known forecasting firm. And he's really good with economic data on labor. And I said, can you just dig into this? What's the deal? Does this affect big businesses? And he said, not really. In a big sense, the thing that is holding back the economy is a skills mismatch, that if you asked employers, what do you really need to have your business improve, most would say, we need better skilled workers, not so much these hours issues. But for on the micro level, on the day-to-day of who, you know, can women make it work to come into the workplace? Can you take care of aging parents and children and make it all come together? For individuals and families, these are important issues. For people who haven't had a minimum wage raise in a couple of years, that's pretty important to them. So all of these issues matter to people, but in terms of the overall growth, not so much.
Marilyn G. Wex is a senior business editor for NPR. She was kind enough to join us once again in our studios here in Washington, D.C. Marilyn, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Police in New Orleans are investigating a shooting that took place yesterday during a Mother's Day parade. New Orleans Police Chief Ronald Serpas says law enforcement is still investigating the matter.
It appears that these two or three people, just for a reason unknown to us, started shooting at, towards, or in the crowd. It was over in just a couple seconds. Police were everywhere.
We'll be following this story, so please stay tuned to your public radio station and NPR.org for more information as this story develops. But now we'd like to turn to another story out of New Orleans, an effort to expand that city's food choices. You might wonder why that's necessary in a city that is world-renowned for its cuisine. But our next guest tells us that the Big Easy also has food deserts. Those are neighborhoods without ready access to fresh, healthy food. And that prompted him to try to do something about it. We're talking here about actor Wendell Pierce. He stars in HBO's New Orleans drama, Tremé, playing musician Antoine Baptiste. Here's a clip.
I need your love so badly. I love you, oh, so madly. But I don't stand a ghost of a chance with you. Oh, with you.
And Wendell Pierce, along with his partners, have invested in a chain of convenience stores and a full-service grocery store, which has just opened, and he is with us now. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you grew up in New Orleans. Do you remember food deserts, as they are now called? I mean, we didn't call them that then, but do you remember this being an issue back when you were growing up?
It wasn't a major issue. It wasn't an issue for me, definitely. But in the lower Ninth Ward, you know, there hasn't been a decent grocery store in 20 years. So just as I was leaving New Orleans for New York, it started to become an issue. And it's something that, for me, growing up in New Orleans, where so much of the culture is based around food, is unacceptable.
Well, how did this happen? Do you know? I mean, how did it come about that there were areas where it's just hard to get fresh food?
Well, it's something that's happening all over the country, and American industry has decided that certain neighborhoods, for whatever reasons, aren't viable, aren't some projected area that they should be investing in, where they have decided to stand on the sidelines and not kind of participate in the economic exchange that happens with their consumer base there. And what happens in these underserved areas, people have demonstrated their loyalty to the stores by having to travel a distance, showing loyalty to their brand and to the product. And all they ask in return is that those same American stores come to their neighborhoods, but they choose to stand on the sidelines. And that's where we are different. At Sterling Farms, we're saying we're stepping up to the plate. We're actually going to those areas that are underserved because we see them as emerging markets.
Did Hurricane Katrina make it worse?
Yeah, it did, you know, because so many people were displaced. So many neighborhoods were destroyed. 80% of the city was destroyed. And then as I returned home and started to rebuild my neighborhood in Pontchartrain Park, I realized that you can't ask people to come back if you don't have the commercial strips coming back, the commercial districts coming back. And that's when I started to do the research and realized that so much of New Orleans was also suffering from food deserts.
What was the most difficult thing about getting this all done?
Well, first of all, the mechanics and logistics of opening a grocery store. As an actor, I can tell you, I had a quick and sharp learning curve. There's a lot of work, a lot of moving parts, but the most difficult part is making sure that everybody was on board when it comes to the banking institutions, my partners, and everyone, you know, participating in the business sense to make sure that it was a viable idea to them, to show them to the economic benefits, and to see those areas, as I said before, as an opportunity and not something that you should be adverse to.
Was the issue specific to New Orleans or specific to the kind of neighborhood you're trying to serve? I mean, by that I mean, is it that when you first approach people who have the wherewithal to get this done and to invest in these kinds of businesses, is it that they don't believe that there could possibly be a food desert in New Orleans, or do they feel that the people there don't want fresh food? What's the mentality that's the first hurdle that you have to overcome?
The mentality is they know that they have a captured consumer, you know, a consumer that they know has to travel to get food. They don't have to invest in that neighborhood. They don't have to go to that area. And they still know that they can count on that consumer coming to their store. And so when that happens, there's sort of an economic apathy that happens and says, listen, I don't have to even make an investment of time, energy, of brick and mortar and go into a community. That community has to come to me because they have no other choice. And so it puts them in a position of no competition, and also knowing that those consumers are going to come to their store. The one thing that happens now is the consumers realize that if a store takes the chance and the risk that we've taken to come into the neighborhood, Oh, we woke our competitors up. Our competitors have all of a sudden come to the store. You know, at one point there was one grocer who came there and said, this may be some trifle for Wendell Pierce, but I'm a grocer who's been at the game for 30 years, and who is he to open a store? All of a sudden, he had competition that he didn't have before because he knew those consumers, as underserved as they were, they still had that pent-up demand and that they would travel to his store. Now we're giving them the alternative, like you and I have, just walk out our door and go to our neighborhood grocery destination, and then he now has to compete.
What I was going to ask you is, what was the key to getting this done? Was it your participation? I mean, was it the fact that there are people like you with a track record? I mean, you have a track record now, having worked in housing development and redeveloping the neighborhood. Do you think it was you? What do you think was the key to overcoming the resistance?
I think there's a combination of advocacy from people in the neighborhood who said, please come and help us bring the industries and the stores that we want in our neighborhood, especially a grocery store. It's just my personal advocacy and belief that New Orleans is too great of a city and these communities are too great of neighborhoods not to have all the services that I take for granted when I come to New York and when I, you know, go to California and all the services that I had. It's the memory of that Friday night grocery trip that I used to take with my mother. It was the town square, you know, men and women getting off of work, and you would see them at our neighborhood grocery store for, you know, a little 8-year-old boy that was, you know, the fishmonger and the butcher. These were, you know, common people in my life on the beginning of my weekend, and I felt as though that was something culturally that everybody should have in their neighborhood to see that it goes away.
I'm laughing because this is really where I find things out at the grocery store on Friday night.
It really is.
This is where I find out what needs to happen or what's going on in the neighborhood. That's where it all is.
and so just seeing that and then also just convincing people that it's actually a viable business plan and model. And I think putting all of that on the table and whatever celebrity I brought to it helped to define the issue and bring some light to the issue.
So your first full-service store has been open for a few weeks now. How has the neighborhood responded? How is it going?
Oh, the neighborhood has responded wonderfully. They're so happy to have a decent, clean store, quality product, you know, world-class customer service, but more importantly, affordable.
Well, keep us posted.
I will.
What's your favorite aisle?
My favorite aisle is aisle number one, the produce. Fresh vegetables, fresh fruit. Something I need to eat more of, and we all should eat more of. And just bringing a decent grocery store to the neighborhood is something that I'm proudest of.
If I pop in and see you in the bakery, I'm going to talk about you.
I'll be greeting you at the front door.
Okay. Wendell Pierce is an actor and now grocer investor in Sterling Express and Sterling Farms. That is a chain of convenience stores and full-service grocery stores now serving New Orleans. And he was kind enough to join us from NPR Studios in New York City, where we caught up with him. Wendell Pierce, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Next, we want to talk about a debate going on that could affect the 47 million Americans who now receive food stamps. That program is now called the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. Throughout the years, there's always been debate about what people should be able to buy with those benefits. But now, as more attention has turned to the country's growing problem with excess weight, some activists are wondering why taxpayer money should be used for soda or other sweetened drinks. One of the groups raising questions is the conservative think tank, the National Center for Public Policy Research. The center's Justin Danhoff is with us now in our Washington, D.C. studios. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Michelle.
Also with us, University of Illinois Professor Craig Gunderson. He has written extensively about SNAP, and he disagrees that there should be restrictions, and he's with us from NPR member station WILL. That's in Urbana, Illinois. Thank you, Professor, for joining us as well.
Thank you for the opportunity.
So, Justin Danhoff, why did you start thinking about the whole question of soda and food stamps or nutrition benefits? I mean, soda is now permitted. There are some things that are not permitted. Like, for example, you can't buy tobacco products with SNAP benefits, but that's not food.
Sure. So, well, you also can't buy alcohol. What got us looking into this initially was the federalism issue. So in the state of Florida and the state of New York, there have been efforts to limit the ability for SNAP recipients to use these taxpayer funds towards sugary beverages like soda. And these efforts have been fought by the Coca-Colas of the world and the Pepsis of the world and also Kraft of the world. And it got us to thinking, why should taxpayers support some of the largest corporations in the world providing sugary beverages. Between Pepsi and Coke in 2012, they had over $100 billion in revenues. What we've got an issue is we've got one of the most powerful governments in the history of the world, the United States federal government, teaming up with powerful corporations to lobby and continue this ever-growing program. If you want to take your own money and buy Coke, I have no problem with that. I'm one of the biggest free market activists you're going to find. That's why I think Mayor Bloomberg's efforts in New York City to limit soda size was wrong, because he was limiting that for everybody. If I have my own money, fine. This is my tax dollar money.
Okay, there's a lot going on there. So let's try to piece a little bit about, let's try to unpack a little bit of that. But Craig Gunderson, why don't you just talk a little bit about the nutritional aspect of this? I don't think anybody disagrees that there really is no nutritional benefit in sweetened drinks. So on that basis, does Mr. Danhoff have a point?
I have to respectfully disagree on this point. I should note that this is billed as a soda ban, but it really bans a wide array of different drinks. For example, V8 would be banned from purchases. Gatorade would be banned. Lipton green tea. There's a whole wide array of beverages that would be banned, including some that we think are healthy. This is a bad idea for five main reasons. The first one is we know that SNAP is an enormously successful program. It leads to reductions in food insecurity. It leads to reductions in poverty in the United States. And moreover, there's lots of evidence that it leads to reductions in obesity. The second reason is this would hurt small business owners across the United States. It's not cheap to reconfigure things to, such that some goods are accepted by SNAP, other goods are not. And this will create longer lines in these stores and raise food prices, which tends to hurt smaller businesses more. The third reason I'm against this is it creates a bureaucratic nightmare. The last thing we need is more government intervention in terms of what we can eat and what we can't eat. And where does this stop? Do we start banning white bread, which really has very little nutritional content? If vegetarians took over in the USDA, would we then ban meat from being consumed? There's a whole wide array of other things that could be banned, along with products like V8 and Gatorade.
The fact is there is already a long list of things that's banned. You can't buy beer, wine, other alcohol. You can't buy soap or household supply. You can't even buy vitamins or medicines. You can't even buy hot food. And, you know, I think some people find that kind of questionable. Like, for example, I mean, how many of us hasn't stopped at the store and bought a rotisserie chicken on the way home because we're hungry and tired and would like to get dinner on the table quickly? So there's already a long list of things that are not permitted to be bought with SNAP benefits. So why would it be so much more challenging to say that something that, I mean, do you disagree that soda has no nutritional benefit?
I don't disagree with this, but if I could first turn to my final two points regarding why I think this is a bad idea, is the first one is it's patronizing and offensive to poor people. When I used to work for the federal government, the USDA didn't give me a paycheck and then say, this is what you can spend your money on. Or when people get Social Security, nobody says, here's how you can spend your money. The fifth reason is this will cause declines in the well-being of poor people in the United States. Fewer will want to participate in a program because it's patronizing, stigmatizing to have all these restrictions. It's more of a hassle for them. That means that hunger rates will rise in the United States. It means poverty rates will rise in the United States. And as I mentioned before, obesity rates are likely to rise in the United States due to these policies.
Could you answer my question, though? Do you really think that not buying a soda is going to discourage that many people from participating in the program? And do you really agree that taxpayer funds should be used to buy something that has no nutritional benefit?
My main problem is we're singling out sugar-sweetened beverages when there's many, many other things that also are not nutritionally that healthy that, along the same lines, if we're going to put forth this argument, is there's a wide array of things that also should be banned. And when you get down to it, is that at some point in the supermarket, you're only dealing with very few things. So I'm in favor of more limited government in terms of dictating what we can and cannot purchase with this. And as I said, this goes beyond just banning soda. It bans many other products as well.
Okay, Mr. Danhoff, what about Mr. Gunderson's point that this is really patronizing and that it's a little hypocritical for people who are conservative, who generally believe in a limited government imprint in people's lives, are advancing an argument like this?
I take the point. I disagree in that what's the new stigma? What's an added stigma? You already can't buy a laundry list of items. All we're saying is a very logical point that this sugary beverage of soda, which has zero nutritional value, should be added to the list. Folks shouldn't be consuming this on a regular basis. And so they should use the SNAP items for nutritional items. If they have discretionary money, fine, use it for a luxury item. But there's so many recipients of SNAP already that run out in the third week of the month. And to spend it on high-priced things like soda, that's just wasting the limited resources we already give them. And I want them, the record 47.7 million Americans on food stamps, to work to get off. This is already government intrusion in their lives. This is just changing the way the government's intruding in their lives.
I have to ask, there are lots of people who receive federal benefits in order to subsidize what we consider a minimally decent standard of living. And among those people are people who receive benefits for disability under Social Security, people who receive veterans benefits. But you're not attaching that kind of question to people who receive those kinds of benefits, telling them what they can and cannot buy. So why not?
The point of veterans benefits isn't the same point as SNAP benefits. The SNAP program is meant to provide nutrition to families who cannot otherwise afford nutritional meals for their family from month to month. We are just saying take something off the table that has no nutritional aspect. We can save the taxpayers some money. The soda industry can afford this change. And
Why not ice cream? Why not say you can't buy ice cream? You can't buy cookies. You can't buy a birthday cake. Why not say that?
In a perfect world, maybe we would say that. But right now, when we have Coke and Pepsi spending millions to lobby to keep these billions, I want to focus on those two companies.
Justin Danhoff is director of the Free Enterprise Project at the National Center for Public Policy Research. That's a policy and research organization, a conservative one in the Washington, D.C. area. Craig Gunderson is a professor in the Department of Agricultural and Consumer Economics at the University of Illinois. His particular interest is food insecurity and food assistance programs. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.